This is VOA News. Via remote, I'm Diane Roberts. U.S. President Joe Biden has emerged from isolation after a five-day period during which he had COVID-19. We get the details from VOA's chief national correspondent, Steve Herman, in Washington.
Speaking for nearly 10 minutes in the White House Rose Garden on Wednesday, President Biden declared himself fully recovered from COVID-19 after he tested negative.
My symptoms were mild. My recovery was quick, and I'm feeling great.
Biden also noted the contrast between his experience with COVID-19 compared to his immediate predecessor, Donald Trump, who became infected before vaccines were available and treatment options were limited.
When my predecessor got COVID, he had to get helicoptered to Walter Reed Medical Center. He was severely ill. Thankfully, he recovered. When I got COVID, I worked from upstairs of the White House and the offices upstairs. And for that five-day period.
The president said while the coronavirus is still with us, especially the highly infectious BA5 variant, COVID-19 deaths are down nearly 90% from when he took office in January of 2021 due to widespread vaccinations and Paxlovid, a pill Biden described as a life-saving drug. Steve Herman, VOA News, Washington.
Ukrainian troops have struck a strategic bridge essential for Moscow to supply its forces occupying the country's south. The deputy head of the Moscow-appointed administration for the Kherson region says the Ukrainian military struck the Antonovsky Bridge across the Dnieper River late Tuesday. He said the bridge remains standing, but its surface is pierced with holes, forcing a halt to traffic. The nearly one-mile-long bridge sustained serious damage in previous Ukrainian shelling last week. This is VOA News. U.S. President Joe Biden and China's Xi Jinping will speak Thursday, according to a U.S. official, coming amid new tensions between Washington and Beijing over China's claims on Taiwan. Beijing warns it will take forceful measures if House Speaker Nancy Pelosi visits the self-ruled island that China claims as part of its territory. If she does, AP correspondent Donna Warder reports the Pentagon is developing plans.
Officials tell the Associated Press that if Nancy Pelosi flies to Taiwan, the military would likely provide overlapping rings of protection with fighter jets, ships, surveillance, and other military systems in the air and on the ground. Pelosi would be the highest-ranking U.S. elected official to visit Taiwan since 1997. Discussion of a trip comes at a time when China has escalated what the U.S. and its allies in the Pacific describe as risky one-on-one confrontations with other militaries. China considers self-ruling Taiwan its own territory and has raised the prospect of annexing it by force. President Joe Biden said last week that a Pelosi trip to Taiwan is, quote, not a good idea right now, end quote. Donna Warder, Washington.
The UN Rapporteur on Violence Against Women urged Turkey Wednesday to reverse its decision to drop out of a European treaty combating gender-based abuses. The treaty requires member states to adopt legislation that strictly punishes domestic abuse and gender-based violence. Japan's Minister for Gender Equality called the country's dangerously low births and plunging population a national crisis and blamed indifference and ignorance in the male-dominated Japanese parliament for the neglect. People in a southwestern Japanese city have come under attack from monkeys that are trying to snatch babies and biting and clawing at flesh. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma has more.
User-generated content footage shows a monkey at the door looking for a way into a resident's apartment. Authorities in Yamaguchi say a woman was assaulted while hanging laundry on her veranda, while another victim has had her toes bitten. People say they've been taken aback and frightened by how big and fat the monkeys are. The species is the Japanese macaque, the kind often pictured peacefully bathing in hot springs. The attacks, nearly 60 since early July, are getting so bad Yamaguchi City Hall has hired a special unit to hunt the animals with tranquilizer guns. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
And recapping our top story, U.S. President Joe Biden has emerged from isolation after a five-day period during which he had COVID-19. If you'd like more on these and other stories, visit us at voanews.com via remote. I'm Diane Roberts, VOA News.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehias Wuhib in Washington. And coming up on Africa News Tonight...
I know that the Western media presents the situation in a totally distorted manner, if only to mention the food crisis, so-called food crisis, as if nothing was of concern before February this year.
That was Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov as he wrapped up a four-country African trip with a stop in Ethiopia. Details coming up. Also, French President Emmanuel Macron is in Benin today, the second stop on a three-country trip to Africa to strengthen political and security ties. These stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov lashed out at Western countries today as he wrapped up a four-nation trip to Africa with a stop in Ethiopia's capital. Moscow is seeking to bolster support from African countries who have largely declined to condemn Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Lavrov's visit comes as the U.S. announced nearly $500 million in additional aid for drought relief in Ethiopia. Fred Harter reports from the capital, Addis Ababa.
At a Wednesday news briefing in Addis Ababa, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov denied Western assertions that his country's invasion of Ukraine is responsible for the global surge in food prices. Lavrov said prices were rising before Russia invaded Ukraine in February due to the COVID-19 pandemic and what he called green policies pursued by the West. He also claims that any additional increases in grain prices were the result of American and European sanctions on Russia.
I know that the Western media presents the situation in a totally distorted manner, if only to mention the food crisis, so-called food crisis, as if nothing was of concern before February this year.
Lavrov is on the last leg of an Africa tour that has included Egypt, Uganda and the Republic of the Congo. He has sought to reassure regional leaders that grain exports through Ukraine's Black Sea ports will resume, while pinning the blame for their halt on the West. Lavrov alleged Wednesday that the sanctions imposed on Russia are a sign that the United States wants a return to what he called a colonial world order.
The West created a system which was based on certain principles: free market, fair competition, sanctity of the private property, presumption of innocence, something else. All these principles have been thrown down the drain when they needed to do what they believe is to punish Russia.
While in Addis, Lavrov met with the Ethiopian Foreign Minister, Demeke Mekonnen. The pair agreed to strengthen cooperation and economic ties, according to state media. There is no indication that Lavrov met with Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed, who has not been seen in public lately, or with officials from the African Union headquarters in Addis Ababa. AU officials told VOA that Lavrov's stop was a bilateral visit between Russia and Ethiopia. Earlier Wednesday, the US government announced a package of $488 million to help Ethiopia with drought relief efforts. Dry weather and conflict have left 30 million Ethiopians in need of aid. Announcing the new funds, Tracy Ann Jacobson, the US chargé d'affaires in Ethiopia, said weather conditions across the region were the worst in recorded history. The new US Special Envoy for the Horn, Mike Hammer, is expected to arrive in Ethiopia on Wednesday, his first visit to the country, where the US is supporting efforts to mediate between the federal government and rebels from the Tigray region in the north. Fred Harter for VOA News, Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
Russia has been aggressively pursuing its strategic objectives in Africa in recent years, securing a foothold in the eastern Mediterranean, gaining naval port access in the Red Sea, expanding natural resource extraction opportunities, displacing Western influence, and promoting alternatives to democracy as a regional norm. Paul Stronsky is a senior fellow in Carnegie's Russia and Eurasia program. Until January 2015, Stronsky served as a senior analyst for Russian domestic politics in the U.S. State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research. His latest article is titled, "Late to the Party, Russia's Return to Africa." I first asked him what Russia's objectives in Africa are.
Well, I think there's multiple objectives. Mm-hmm. I think Russia sees Africa as potential or as a real partner in its efforts to move beyond a unipolar, Western-dominated, American-dominated international system. You have some very, you know, important, whether it's in North Africa or Sub-Saharan Africa, you have key Russian partners, South Africa, Egypt, for example, that Russia sees as important for its vision of a multipolar world, one where rising and emerging economies have a greater say over how sort of the international system functions. So I think that's one. I think two is Putin's Kremlin is very opportunistic. It's not doesn't have a broad strategy per se, but it looks at areas where it can make inroads. And I think we've seen over the last 5 or 6 years, the West having a lot of difficulties in Africa. We've pivoted away from Africa. We're not as engaged in Africa as we were before. And at times we have been overbearing in Africa. So Russia sees opportunity. It sees opportunity to play to anti-colonial legacies that are still there. And it also sees opportunities to insert itself into some of the continent's regional conflicts and ethnic conflict, particularly places where the United States, France, Europe have pulled back. So it is very eager to step into, you know, we've seen it, what it does in the Central African Republic, very eager to make similar inroads, Mali, Burkina Faso. So you see a lot of that as well. So I think some of this is the strategy of a multipolar world. Some of it is opportunism. And then I think there is, you know, a little bit of as the West tries to isolate Russia over Ukraine, you know, this, you know, Africa is a key part of the globe where Russia still has partners, friends, and it's trying to make the most of that to show these efforts at isolation are basically isolation from the West, not necessarily isolation from the rest of the world.
So Russia's Africa-focused initiatives are typically concentrated on propping up an embattled incumbent here or a close ally there. And we have examples like Khalifa Haftar in Libya, Faustin Archand Touadera in the Central African Republic, coup leader Assimi Goïta in Mali, Lieutenant General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan in Sudan, among others. So is this what you'd call the modus operandi for Russia as we move forward?
I certainly think Russia is making some of its biggest inroads in countries that have some pretty horrible human rights records. There are countries that are, you know, run by, you know, military authoritarian leaders. These are like-minded folks for the Russians. And the Russians come in, they don't ask questions, and they might deliver weapons, they might deliver economic goods without asking for any good governance, without asking for any human rights, without making a whole lot of demands on how these countries are governed. Russia is not very well invested in the populations of these countries. It's mostly invested in the elites, the economic elites, and the political elites. And you've seen in places that have more robust civil societies, that could be Kenya, that could be Ghana, that could even be South Africa, where the Zuma government came crashing down over allegations of corruption that had Russian fingerprints all over them. In places where you have more of a bottom-up society, Russia is having more difficulty. So it finds these types of strongmen very convenient. And also the fact that many of these people have very bad relations with other parts of the world, with the United States, with Europe. They might be isolated globally, but Russia is certainly willing to sort of help shore them up.
And that was Paul Stronsky, senior fellow in Carnegie's Russia and Eurasia program. He talked to me from Washington. With less than 2 weeks before Kenya's elections, millions of Kenyans watched a presidential debate Tuesday that had only one debater. Deputy President William Ruto appeared solo after his main opponent, Raila Odinga, refused to participate in the live event. Mohammed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
Deputy President had the stage to himself for 90 minutes to answer questions and explain what he will do if he occupied the president's office.
We are a country that is faced with mounting challenges. We have a huge track record of what we have achieved, but there is tremendous opportunity out there for more to be achieved. And I believe I am the candidate with a plan to be able to get Kenya to the next level.
He promised, among other things, to reduce the cost of living and fight corruption. Former Prime Minister Raila Odinga pulled out of the debate last week, saying he was not willing to debate someone who had no regard for ethics and public morals. Ruto responded Tuesday night.
My competitor is not here because he doesn't have a plan. He doesn't have an agenda. He cannot articulate anything to the people of Kenya. That's why it's not here.
A recent survey found Odinga holding a strong lead over Ruto heading into the final weeks before the August 9th election. Ruto has been deputy president for the past 10 years and held ministerial positions in the previous government. Michael Agwanda, a Kenyan political commentator, says Ruto is having trouble shaking off the political blame that comes with incumbency.
I strongly believe that he was caught in between a hard place and a rock, because he's been part of the system for a very long time. And therefore, when he was coming out and he was saying that his hands were held and that he had limited power, and yet later on he said that he had influence in government, that was more or less, not being straightforward.
Nairobi resident Melanie Businei watched Tuesday's debate. She says it has changed her mind on who she will be voting for come August 9th. Though she did not reveal which candidate she now prefers.
I just hope for the best, and definitely yesterday's debate has changed who I was supposed to vote for. The fact that I have seen who can commit and who cannot, the promises and the agendas have always been the same since independence.
Matilda Murage said she did not watch the debate. She says previous unfulfilled promises of earlier leaders have made her not vote.
I don't trust anybody there. There's nobody I want to give my vote to, because they lie, they steal. I'll just rather keep my vote.
Ruto, who is 55, is running for the Kenyan presidency for the first time. The 77-year-old Odinga is making his fifth bid for the top job. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
French President Emmanuel Macron is in Benin today, the second stop on a three-country trip to Africa to strengthen political and security ties. Reuters quotes a French official as saying Paris would be responding to requests for air support, intelligence and equipment to fight Islamic radicals in the region. Analysts say France also aims to strengthen African armies in the region and help them to take the lead against the extremists. In recent months, Benin and other Gulf of Guinea states have suffered increasing attacks by extremists as violence spreads from the Sahelian countries of Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger. During talks with Cameroon's President Paul Biya yesterday, Macron said France would also help encourage local investments in a bid to increase food production. Food shortages and inflation have worsened in Africa in large part to Russia's war in Ukraine and a drop in grain exports from the two countries to the continent. Macron will complete his trip to Africa tomorrow with a stop in Guinea-Bissau. His visit comes as France continues to pull its troops out of Mali, which has been fighting an 11-year-old jihadist campaign. Malawian President Lazarus Chakwera launched a nationwide anti-corruption campaign yesterday at the end of a two-day conference on graft. While many Malawians have welcomed the campaign as a step forward, others are skeptical and note that similar past efforts failed to stamp out official fraud. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre, Malawi.
Malawian President Lazarus Chakwera launched a nationwide anti-corruption campaign Tuesday at the end of a two-day conference on graft. While many Malawians have welcomed the campaign as a step forward, others are skeptical and note that similar past efforts failed to stamp out official fraud. Lameck Masina reports from Blantyre, Malawi.
Corruption is our biggest enemy, I can say. And is not welcome here.
President Lazarus Chakwera launched a 20-week anti-corruption campaign with a call for Malawians to recite and abide by the campaign's slogan, quote, corruption is our biggest enemy and is not welcome here.
This is an important campaign that we're starting today. It is important because every time we each say those words, we will make it known to those around us what we think of corruption and what we are personally committed to do about it.
This is the first national anti-corruption campaign during the Chakwera's administration, which started in 2020. During the launch, Chakwera also co-signed statements of commitments from 12 institutions that detailed their plans of action for fighting corruption. The 12 stakeholders included the judiciary, civil society organizations, the business community, traditional leaders, and parliament. Fiona Kalemba is the clerk of Malawi's parliament.
The legislature pillar commits to the president and the people of Malawi to undertake the following interventions. Review the laws, including the Corrupt Practices Act, the Public Procurement and Disposal of Assets Act, the Public Audit Act, the Political Parties Act, and the Public Finance Management Act. This will be done within the mandate of the legislature and for the purposes of the mandate of the legislature.
Also, the business community pledged to name and shame businesses and entrepreneurs involved in corruption and have their names published in the media. The new campaign comes at a time when Malawi is struggling to end corruption. Martha Jizuma is the director of Anti-Corruption Bureau in Malawi.
A week does not pass without new revelations of embezzlement of public funds, corrupt award of public procurement contracts of goods and services, and incidents of abuse of office across the sectors.
The latest report of Transparency International, the Global Corruption Perception Index, ranks Malawi 110 out of 180 countries, which Chakwera said is worrying. However, some Malawians are skeptical and note that similar past efforts failed to stamp out official fraud. George Piri is a former political sciences lecturer at the University of Livingstonia in northern Malawi. He welcomes the campaign, but doubts whether it will reach its goal.
For this campaign to reach its goal, it will be until we see those who have been involved in corrupt practices and have been arrested, their cases taken to court and prosecuted and judgment passed on those who are guilty. That is when I will see that indeed what has happened today has come to the expectations of Malawians.
Chizuma, the director of Anti-Corruption Bureau, said the government cannot interfere with the Bureau's operations if the campaign is to meet its goal. Lameck Masina for VOA News, Blantyre, Malawi.
Ethiopia's civil war among Tigrayan forces, the federal government and regional forces has ruined some occupied towns and displaced millions of people. The United Nations says about 295,000 people are now returning to the towns in a remote corner of Ethiopia's northern Afar region. A handful of locals have already gone back to their deserted towns to rebuild their lives. Henry Wilkins reports from Ethiopia's northern Afar region.
In the mountains in Ethiopia's northern Afar region, the district of Kanaba was occupied by Tigrayan forces until late April. Locals say you can still see Tigrayan forces' positions in the hills that border Tigray. Although the town is still mostly empty, civilians who fled violence are gradually returning to rebuild their lives since forces aligned with the Tigray People's Liberation Front, or the TPLF, left behind a trail of destruction. Among those civilians is Mohamed Abdullah Mohamed, a local administrator. He says many people have returned to their homes, but many of those properties have been ransacked. He says there are no shops or markets anymore and that there's severe hunger, with many children suffering from hunger and lack of food. UN and local authorities say of around 300,000 people displaced by the conflict in the Afar region, about 295,000 have spontaneously returned to their homes in recent weeks. Stina Abdallah returned to the nearby town of Bahale in June with her son. She explains that when the TPLF entered the city, she fled with her family to save herself, leaving behind everything, including their homes and livestock. We did not find anyone to help us. We ran away, but now we have returned. Everything is gone. The TPLF took with them everything they could steal and destroyed everything, even the houses, she added. Local officials showed VOA many homes and businesses that had been burned or ransacked. The TPLF did not respond to a request for comment on the destruction of civilian buildings in Afar, but it has denied targeting civilians in the past. Rights groups accuse all parties to Ethiopia's conflict of abuse against civilians and infrastructure. Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch say in other parts of the country, such as the disputed region of Western Tigray, ethnic cleansing against Tigrayans has taken place. In Afar, the local administrator in the town of Arepti, Mohamed Aliou, says loss of infrastructure is taking a major toll. He points out that electricity is not available. He says they had a special generator in the past which could be used during a power cut, but it was destroyed by the TPLF. The situation is now difficult here. No electricity, no internet, not even a phone. There are associations that served the citizens in this area and provided water extraction equipment and contributed to saving energy, he says. In the town of Bahale, Kadir Hussein, an administrator, says medical services were disrupted because they were targeted and destroyed. He says there is a lot of damage to health facilities. In total, around 16 health facilities that used to provide services to citizens were destroyed. The TPLF says its forces entered the Afar region to break a humanitarian blockade imposed by the government and the Afar Regional Administration, and only retreated after a ceasefire that allowed aid into Tigray. Meanwhile, in Tigray, the humanitarian blockade means access to medical care is a major issue too, with hospitals being forced to close. The UN's International Organization for Migration says those returning home to Afar and beyond urgently need assistance.
The substandard shelter, the shelter accommodation, but also how it has affected the livelihoods. As it's a combination of factors, the drought, the conflict, the losing of assets. Then in the communities that have been affected by conflict, of course, there's also the disruption of services.
While Tigray is inaccessible to journalists, all indications are that the humanitarian situation is similarly desperate. The World Food Programme said last week essential food aid has now been distributed in the region, but government-imposed fuel restrictions still make it difficult for food to reach rural areas. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Northern Afar, Ethiopia.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Cedric Franklin, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station.